America's most beautiful brownstone neighborhoods. In fact, there are four houses in my book that are in the village, and I'm going to be showing those later, along with the Charleston house that's an incredible restoration by the Greenwich Village architect, you may know, Gil Schaefer. I also want to say, what a thrill it is to get a glimpse inside the famous Salma Bundi Arts Club. I've never been inside before. It's an incredible brownstone. The Salma Bundi Club has been located in this brownstone, you may know, since 1917. And some of my heroes, including Bucky Fuller, have been members here. And I've also heard a lot about the Salma Bundi stew in the dining room, which I've never had, but here it's good. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah?
Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to start by telling you a little bit about myself and about the book, and later I'll get into the houses and show you a lot of pictures. Right now, I just have some photos to go with what's really the story behind the book. I grew up in Montreal, and like a lot of young professionals trying to get into publishing, I moved to New York. I wanted to be in the heart of the action, so I moved into an old tenement building in the East Village, actually, and that's where I started my career as a design editor. Then I met my husband, who's here tonight, Joel Simon. We started a family, and we needed more space. So we moved to Brooklyn, and for space, but from, this is us leaving Manhattan behind. Bye. We're moving to Brooklyn. It was really more than space. We were looking for a lifestyle change, a calmer pace of life, without giving up any of the benefits of being right in the city. Now, my husband had grown up in a brownstone in Brooklyn. In the 70s, his parents bought a shell of a brownstone in Boreham Hill, and the interior had been destroyed in a fire. His best friend was the writer Jonathan Lethem, and if you've ever read Jonathan's book, The Fortress of Solitude, which describes what Brooklyn and that neighborhood in particular was like in the 1970s, you'll understand why Joel and his family moved as far away as they possibly could to California, and for that matter, so did Jonathan. But they're all back now. But this was 30 years later, and I didn't have any of that baggage, and I had never lived in a brownstone neighborhood. Looking around, I was smitten by the lifestyle, the tree-lined streets, the mix of residential architecture with local shops, and everything Jane Jacobs described I was seeing on the streets of Brooklyn. The fact that people walked everywhere, that different generations were living side by side, often in the same house, and the houses were gorgeous. Exquisite details, the front doors carved like antiques. People talk, I'm a design writer, and green architecture, that is the buzz, build green. But to me, the more I learned about these houses, the more I realized that this was the original green architecture. When these houses were built, resources like heat, electricity, which are expensive today, at the time were luxuries, and houses were built to conserve. So everything from the shutters to the shared walls with their neighbors kept houses insulated, not to mention the vertical layout, which is such an efficient use of space, and the fact that they were near the trains, so people could walk everywhere. To me, it doesn't get any greener, and of course they're still located near public transportation, and just as green as they ever were. Now, we bought our house from a friend who had just completed a big renovation, so I never had the experience of moving walls around. But the more I learned about our brownstone, the more I don't have to tell everyone in this room that living in an old house, it's just, they require constant care and feeding. Meanwhile, as I walk my kids to school every day, I love, you know, my favorite pastime was peeking inside people's windows and sneaking a look inside. And I was so impressed at the many different solutions that people came up with. Some houses, this is not, again, not working. Maybe I'm just too quick on the draw. Okay. It's a load. Sorry about that. Anyways, some of the houses were packed with antiques, others were thoroughly modern, and others mixed the styles. And yet, no matter the approach, I spotted so many homes that were successful on their own terms. I knew that there were some terrific books on historic townhouses, but nothing that had the answers that my friends and I were looking for. We wanted creative ideas for our home, inspiration that was stylish and up-to-date. But we were also searching for solid, practical information. So when it came time to hire the guy to reface our brownstone, or replace or restore our windows, we had information that we needed so we could make a good decision. So in addition to the 21 beautiful houses in the book, there are lots of practical entries on topics such as woodwork, windows, entries. Those are some of the slides that I just showed. One of the themes of my book is that living in an antique home doesn't mean you have to live in a museum. You know, leave the heavy draperies and the drawing room to the Victorians. We need efficient kitchens and homes that once had living servants, and modern bathrooms and houses where plumbing was once a luxury. It can be a challenge to strike the right balance between old and new. But as the renovations in my book show, an old house can be surprisingly adaptable. Let me tell you a little bit about the history of the townhouse. These are houses where the layout is vertical, usually 3 to 6 stories. The architecture originated in Europe and came to America in the 18th century. Row houses are townhouses that are connected. The idea was to create a unified front with the harmonious appearance of a European palace. The houses in my book span 160 years and are found in cities including San Francisco, Washington, D.C., Savannah, and Canada. Here are the styles that I cover. This is a Philadelphia colonial built in 1763. Federal townhouse. Maybe some of you have walked by it in the village. The book includes several Greek Revival houses here in New York and Charleston, Savannah. There are many Italianate-style homes from the Victorian period, which can be found everywhere from Chicago to New Orleans to Baltimore. This is a double-wide brownstone in Troy, New York, on a square so intact they used it for the set of Age of Innocence. There are townhouses built at the height of the Industrial Revolution, like this Edwardian, San Francisco. And finally, I cover the wide-ranging styles of the eclectic movement in the early 20th century, when wealthy homeowners no longer wanted their houses to look exactly like their neighbors. Many of the, instead of having houses in a row, at that time, real estate was a lot more expensive, and if you had the money to build a townhouse, you wanted it to be unique. This one is a limestone on Embassy Row in Washington, D.C., where it began as a private home built by Cleveland's bottle cap king, Edward Everett. Then it became the Chancellery of Oman and was carved up into office space. And now it's been restored and is a private home again. And I think that's the trajectory that you're seeing in a lot of townhouse neighborhoods across North America. In Washington, this was a unique case where it became Embassy Row. In the village and many other places, townhouses were carved up into boarding houses, apartments, but there's a trend now to restore them into private homes. Now, rather than organize the homes by historic period, I decided to use a more practical organization and divide them according to the current homeowner's design approach. The first section, restoring tradition. These are homes where the owners tried to bring the houses back to an approximation of what they would have looked like in their heyday. Second section, this is the biggest section in the book, old meets new. These are homes where the architecture meets contemporary style halfway. The final section, modern reinventions. While the facades in these homes are restored and intact, these are houses that push the envelope. And you know, as a preservation society, you might find some of the solutions controversial from a preservation point of view. But keep in mind that a lot of these houses were in very bad shape inside, have been renovated multiple times, and in certain cases, a gut renovation is understandable. Townhouses are a bit like books. This is the fun part of my slideshow. I'm going to take you inside a few of the houses in my book. So in the first section, this is that house you saw earlier, the Federal Townhouse. It's actually on Bank Street. The owner is Robert Duffy. He's the president of Marc Jacobs International. He bought this house, which is the shortest house on this block, in 2001. Actually, it started out even smaller. This is something I discovered doing my research that I found that surprised me. If you have a subscription to the New York Times website, you can Google an address. And often, what they've done is, you know how you used to go to a library and you have to spend hours going through microfiche trying to find an original article? Well, they've scanned them all. Up popped, you know, put in this address, and up popped a really interesting story from an 1893 newspaper. Reporting on a fire that happened in this house after the owner doused her son's mattress with kerosene. It had bed bugs. I don't know if that's the treatment today for bed bugs. they had them then. They still have them, I guess. So there was a big fire in this house. And the living room was added circa 1910. And the dining room was tacked on in the 1970s. Duffy hired an architect named Stephen Jacklich and asked him to tamper as little as possible with his home's original features. If that meant leaving crooked floors, like the ones you see here in the bedroom, or holes in the floorboards, so be it. The biggest alteration was the 1970s dining room addition, which was transformed into a pine panel dining room, which you can see on the top right. Along with the galley kitchen, which is small, but Duffy doesn't do a lot of his own cooking. The black marble mantel at left was original to the house. So now I'm going to take you down south to Charleston. I felt as a preservation society, you would enjoy this, learning about this house, which was probably the most ambitious and purest restoration in my book. It's an 1843 Greek Revival townhouse known as the Gatewood House in Charleston, 9,900 square feet, 48 feet wide. It's got a brick and brownstone facade. The brownstone probably came from up north, Connecticut, and an incredible two-story porch with the classical columns that you see in this picture. In Charleston, a side porch is called a piazza, and it plays two roles, to provide shade in summer and a view of the lovely garden in the side yard that these houses have. This is the house that the village architect, village-based architect Gil Schaefer worked on, but he had a terrific partner. Charleston is home to a really interesting person, the country's probably the top restoration contractor in the United States. Richard Marks, who's also known as Moby Marks. Moby searches houses for what he calls ghost marks, traces of walls moved and other signs of a home's past. It's forensic, the architecture equivalent of CSI, and spends many months doing this. The homeowners are Sarah and Ozzie Horton. She used to be an assistant movie director for people like Clint Eastwood, and he's a management consultant and a 10th generation Charlestonian. They're very serious about preservation, and in fact, they searched for 8 years for a house that had enough original features to make a restoration worthwhile. This building had withstood 10 different owners, a major earthquake, and a few decades as a rooming house. but there were a lot of features intact, including the original kitchen house in the rear, which at one point had been attached to the main house with sort of a passageway that they call a hyphen. Here's the kitchen house. And Schaefer exposed the original framing in the ceiling, but otherwise created the home's most contemporary space. But the rest is a much more pure restoration. Moby discovered that the house was literally coming apart at the seams. The brick in the south walls was seriously damaged. The roof trusses were completely rotted. The ceiling joists in these lovely parlors were on the verge of collapse. One corner of the house had sunk 12 inches. So what did they do? Moby literally took the house apart and reassembled it. The south wall was dismantled, every brick was saved, and the wall was stitched back together with stainless steel tie rods. And on the other side, the wall was pulling away from the internal central staircase and leaning into an alley outside the house. So the solution there was to reinforce the steps with steel channels and use the inner staircase itself as a 32-foot brace to tie the wall back to the property. An incredible feat of engineering for Moby's team. The house was restored room by room. Notice in the dining room, can you see, they're a little bit, it's hard to see here, the triple hung windows, which are original, and very similar to the ones at Monticello. And the wallpaper is hand painted from De Gournay. The bathroom and kitchen house has the original Milsonne cypress. This is a room that would have originally been used for storage, and they've turned it into this beautiful powder room. Old meets new. This is a house a lot of people want to see in my book. It's the Greenwich Village home of Julianne Moore, the actress, and her husband, the director Bart Cronenberg. Julianne, I don't know if any of you know her, but she's very passionate about design, and she does her own decorating. She searched for a long time as well and bought this 1839 Greek Revival home that over the years had been chopped up into tiny apartments. She then brought in a firm that includes her brother-in-law, the architect Oliver Fernlich. The firm is based in Brooklyn. The name is Made. And what she wanted to do was restore the house to its original layout. This is the living room. This is the front parlor. And this is a good example to me of what I saw a lot in the houses in my book. Adapting the original layout of a townhouse for contemporary needs. Julianne decided to turn the front parlor of her house, that stunning room, into her study. I didn't want it to become the fancy room no one uses, she told me. Meanwhile, Oliver and his team took the house apart, and everything that could be saved and restored was, like the original shutters and the Greek Revival doorway. This house was completely, it was a gut renovation, but all the features were saved and put back. Here's another modern adaptation. A movie star bathroom. Julianne's master bathroom takes up an entire bedroom. This is something that I saw a lot in the research for my book. People were, since many of the houses didn't have bathrooms originally, or they were tiny, if they had the space, they would turn a bedroom into a bathroom. I love the way the marble surround around the tub was matched to the room's original mantle. She told me she has young kids. She gives them baths. They like spending time in this room. She also has her team of makeup and clothing people and needed space, and so she wanted this beautiful bathroom. Another interesting thing she did was she decided that she wanted the kitchen to be located on the home's ground level off the garden, which is where it would have been in the 19th century, as I'm sure a lot of you know. That's where most kitchens were in brownstones in this neighborhood and in most brownstones. Now this room, they opened up the walls and found the original hearth left it exposed, the brick wall, and the beam ceiling, which also has the advantage of giving them more more ceiling height. Not to mention they love the indoor-outdoor feeling that they get by having the kitchen located off the garden. There's a section on ornamental plaster. There are sections on different topics, restoration topics in the book. This one explains how companies like Sculpture House, which worked on Julianne's house, restored and replaced the missing plaster work in her home. And one thing I thought they did that was interesting is they didn't try to match the original. You know, you can clearly see what's new and what's old. And a lot of, you know, in the restoration world, a lot of people use that practice so that you can see what was original and historic. This is another house in this neighborhood. I called it Rock and Roll Revival because the owners are Simon Kirk. He was one of the founders of the band Bad Company. He's a drummer. His wife is Lorraine Kirk, a fashion designer. And Lorraine oversaw the renovation with Richard Lewis, an architect she discovered through his work for restaurants like Balthazar and Pastis. This was a house that had been renovated to death. It had almost no period detail. Lorraine was determined to put all of it back. So she set out to find it. Vintage moldings, tin ceilings, fragments of woodwork, and with Lewis's help, put the house back together like a jigsaw puzzle. Here's her dining room, an open kitchen, with bookshelves running above the door and below the moldings. The kitchen. You see that in that picture on the right? That's their eating nook. And Lorraine is the kind of person who buys a tufted sofa, doesn't measure, brings it home, realizes that it doesn't fit the dining nook. So she cut it in half and created this booth. Here's the living room with its original 15-pane windows. And she decided to paint all her window frames black, which I think is very effective. The master bedroom suite. This is her teenage daughter, Lola. This is her very glamorous bedroom suite. The alcove bed was made out of building scraps. I have a 7-year-old who's also named Lola, who got to meet the teenage Lola, and this is her dream bedroom. The house is filled with wonderful bathrooms, each decorated in a different style. On the ground level, there's a separate apartment that Lorraine created for one of her daughters. And the gravel garden on the right was designed by Miranda Brooks, who's a Vogue contributing editor. The final section, modern reinventions, this is where we push it a little further. Again, from this neighborhood. In this project, the front of a 19th century house was restored so beautifully by the architect, Stephen Harris, that it got an award from the American Institute of Architects. You can see it on the right. But inside, the old features were long gone. The house had been renovated and torn apart. Here's the front. Look at it now. The back wall's all glass. The kitchen, which has a marble top kitchen island, you can see here. The bedrooms, on the top left, the master bathroom spans the width of the front of the house. On the bottom right, the master bedroom has window shades that operate by remote control, in case you were wondering about privacy. Although there is a lot of privacy since it's a walled garden. This is the penthouse floor. I don't know if you can make this out, but it's actually three spaces, an outdoor deck, an outdoor terrace, and an indoor room. And the outdoor terrace and the indoor room, you might be able to see, have fireplaces that mirror one another. It looks like an optical illusion. There are actually two of them, one indoors and one outdoors. And look at how the architect reimagined the backyard, which was surrounded by neighboring buildings and had no views, as a walled garden oasis. Nobody would even want to buy this house because of what was considered a liability, but he turned it into, the homeowner, the minute he saw it, he said, well, that's the most private garden in New York City. One final story about the cover image. A lot of people ask me, whose doorway is that? That's a house in Brooklyn Heights. It's owned by a designer named Catherine Scott and her husband, Linda Goob, an artist. The buzzer looks like it's been there forever. In fact, it hasn't. Catherine founded an antique store and for years dreamed of installing it in the doorway of her brownstone in Brooklyn Heights. But it was tricky to do. And she also wanted it to function in a contemporary way. What do we mean by that? It looks like you pull one of the brass knobs and some chime would go off inside the house. But in fact, it's now been wired so that a telephone rings inside the house. And there's a hidden camera so that visitors' faces turn up on a computer monitor inside the house. So that's it. I wanted to leave time for questions. But first, I also want to introduce the photographer of the book, Brian Park. There you are.